Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is your life shaped by the people you know? You can probably cite friends who have turned you on to particular authors or recording artists. Maybe you frequent the same stores and social events as others in your circle. But it appears those things lie at the top of an enormous iceberg. It turns out that our social networks may have a lot to do with our physical and mental health, from our likelihood of becoming obese to the chances we'll either start or quit smoking, to even our moods and tendency to be depressed or content with our lives. My guest today is a leading researcher into the social impact of networks on our individual lives. Nicholas A. Christakis is professor of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine at Harvard University. His new book, written with political scientist James H. Fowler, is called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. Nicholas, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
I'll start by asking you to define social network as it figures into your work. Typically, who is included in these networks?
So I'm glad you started off with that, because many of your listeners, when they hear the term social network, may be thinking the online variety of Facebook and MySpace and all these types of networks which have been with us just for the last few years. But in fact, the kinds of social networks that we are more interested in, I mean, although we do talk about online networks in the book, are the kind of social networks that have been with us since we emerged from the African savanna as human beings. The networks are our ties to everybody we know, our relatives, our friends, our coworkers, all kinds of social connections that I'm connected to. And then, in turn, those people are connected to other people, and those people still to others, in a kind of vast fabric of humanity. So we're all interconnected, as it were, in these enormous social networks that we really don't see and typically don't pay much attention to. And yet, our embeddedness in these networks and the fact that human beings have always lived their lives in social networks has profound implications for our lives.
It's really interesting to me that people tend to be sort of hardwired in terms of how those networks look throughout their lives.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting idea. I mean, most people have now seen pictures of social networks, and if they can conjure up in their mind's eye a picture of a social network, they probably will see this dense tangle of dots and lines, the dots representing people and the lines representing social ties, with maybe a lot of density in the middle and maybe sort of spreading out, feathering towards the edges. One analogy that I often use is Christmas tree lights. If you have a mess of Christmas tree lights, you know, you're trying to untangle them once a year, there's that big mess in the middle, and then the kind of gets looser, and these little tendrils that go out to the periphery, and every light you see might be a person, and the wires might be ties that connect people to each other. But the interesting thing about human social networks is they always pretty much look like that. They have that kind of a shape. And as James and I show in some of our work on the genetics of social networks, and as we discuss in the book as well, this is not a coincidence. And if I might, ask people to think about, if they remember from high school chemistry, a sodium chloride crystal looks just like a little cube, every little dots alternating with dots in a perfect little lattice, a regular lattice. Why don't social networks look like that? They don't look like that. They look in a very particular way, as you alluded to, and the reason they look the particular way they do has to do with our genetics and a bunch of other complicated things.
Yeah, one of the things you did was look at twins to compare what their networks looked like.
That's right, and we found that that identical twins have more similar social networks than the non-identical twins. And this was one of the big clues that something genetic is going on here. Now, I don't want to be too deterministic. I'm not suggesting that your social life is predetermined by your genes, but it is the case that that there's certain aspects of the kind of network you're in that is very genetic. And if I might, let me give an example. We found that it wouldn't surprise most people to know that the number of friends you have is partially genetic. Some people are shy and some are gregarious, and this is partially genetic. And so some people will seek out many friendships and some few. So that's pretty straightforward. But when we looked at this, we actually found a few more things that were kind of bizarre, actually. For example, we found that whether or not your friends know each other depends on your genes. So if you have Tom, Dick, and Harry in a room, whether Dick is friends with Harry depends not just on Dick's genes and Harry's genes, but also on Tom's genes. And so, which is pretty bizarre if you think about it. How can this third party be influencing whether these other two people are friends with one another? And It turns out that we think that what's happening is there's a genetic tendency to introduce your friends. Some people introduce their friends to each other and some do not, just like some people have many friends and some have few. And in addition, finally, we found that whether you're located in the middle of the social network or on the periphery, regardless of how many friends you have, is also partially genetic. So, for example, with that tangle of Christmas tree lights I alluded to earlier, you could have two friends and be located way on the edge of the network, or two friends and located smack in the middle. And this also is partially genetic. So the bottom line is that the structure of our social networks is partially determined by our genes and not just by our own social and psychological desires and situations.
And people who have a wide circle of not necessarily very close friendships typically report being happier in their lives overall than people who have a few very intense friendships.
I think it's complicated, that, actually. I mean, I think that the most important thing, you know, in terms of our happiness work, and we've looked at how happiness spreads through social networks, what we find is that it's not so much how many friends you have, but rather what their emotional state is. So, for example, in the happiness work, James and I have looked at a whole host of things that determine the structure of the social network, but we've also spent a lot of time looking at, okay, given a particular structure, how do things flow through the network? And you've alluded to some of them already, but one of the things that flows are emotions, specifically happiness and unhappiness. And what we find is that there are two determinants of how happy you are. One is how well connected you are in the network, whether you're in the middle or on the edge. And it turns out people in the middle tend to be happier. But the reason is very interesting. So in a way, we've vindicated, you know, all of us in high school that told our parents, oh, if I was only more popular, then I'd be happy, Mom. we've sort of proven that, yes, if you were more popular, you would be happy. But the reason is interesting. The reason has to do with the flow of happiness and unhappiness through the network. And because happiness, as it turns out, flows more reliably than unhappiness, and because people in the middle of a network are more buffeted by things than people on the edge, the people in the middle get more buffeted by happy waves than by sad waves, and therefore are more likely to have a happy emotional state in the future. So, if I might, imagine, again, this type of network I just conjured up in everyone's mind's eye, this complicated path of not in the middle, let's say, in these tendrils towards the edge. Imagine that a deadly germ was spreading in the network. And you're a person with four friends, but you could be located on the periphery or located in the middle of the network. In both cases, you have four friends, and that's all you know. Well, where would you rather be? Would you rather be someone on the edge of the network or in the middle if a deadly germ is going through the network? You'd rather be on the edge. You don't want to be in the middle, because in the middle you can catch the germ from all sides, as it were. And similarly, now imagine that a valuable piece of information were flowing through the network, maybe a piece of gossip. Hopefully not about you, is flowing through the network. Now, again, you'd rather be in the middle, not on the edge, because now you're going to be on the path through which the news is traveling. You're more likely to be on that path. And similarly with emotions, if you're in the middle and these sort of waves of this emotional contagion is taking place, as we think it is, you're going to be more likely to be buffeted by these positive emotions, as it were.
Let's talk about how you studied these networks. You used data from the Framingham study that a lot of people have heard of, but it wasn't set up originally to look at anything like this.
Yeah, we've looked at lots of data sets. The most famous one we've used is the Framingham Heart Study, but we've also looked at data sets of adolescents. We've looked at data sets assembled from phone records to create people's networks. We've looked at other sorts of data as well. But the Framingham Heart Study project is interesting. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into.
We've got an hour.
Story?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the story is sort of, I don't know, it's an interesting story, but it's like when I was working on my PhD dissertation and I'd go to a cocktail party and people would ask me what the dissertation was about and I'd launch into a one-hour discussion of it, and my wife wouldn't, you know, kick me under the table and say, shut up, you know, they just want the two-minute version. So I'll give you the two-minute version, and you can tell me if you still want the hour version. The story is that we were interested in doing a study where we would assemble a large network of people. So we would, let's say, pick 1,000 people and then ask them who 5 of their most socially intimate people were, their spouses and friends and so forth, and that'd be 5,000 people. And then we would ask those 5,000 people who their, let's say, 5 closest friends and contacts were, that'd be 25,000 people, for a total of 31,000 people. And then we wanted to talk to those people, let's say, once every 2 years for 6 years. And we estimated out what this would cost, and it was going to be about $25 million. And the National Institutes of Health, and specifically the National Institute on Aging, which actually funded our work, said to us, look, we're not saying no to this, but do you have any pilot data to support what you want to do? And they gave us some money to do a pilot study, which was really far-sighted of them. This was at the National Institute on Aging. And what we did with the pilot study was just serendipity. We had gone to the Framingham Heart Study, which is, as you said, a very famous study, which began in 1948 with about 2/3 of the adult residents in the town of Framingham, just outside Boston. And we approached them in a way I'll get to in a moment, but let me just tell you about the Framingham Heart Study. So 1948, they get 2/3 of the adults in the town. 1971, they impanel the offspring of those people plus their spouses. 2005, they get the grandchildren plus their spouses. They're following 15,000 people, and they're contacting these people every 2 to 4 years. And all of these people are coming back to be examined by doctors, and this study is one of the main ways we know about the risks of cholesterol and blood pressure and all these things. Anyway, so we go to the Framingham Heart Study, and we say to them, look, we'd like to study just 1,000 of your people and see if we can talk to them about their social networks, learn a little bit about how this is taking place. And in the course of that conversation, the woman there says, look, you know, we have these records that we track the participants in, and in these records we collect information about their family and their friends and where they work and so forth. And it dawned on us that by dumb luck, those people that had been participating, when they said so-and-so is their friend, that so-and-so might also have been in the study. Or when they said they worked at such and such a place, unbeknownst to them, other Framingham Heart Study people had also were also working in such and such a place. So with support from the NIA, we spent about $500,000 in 2 years of our lives painfully reconstructing these paper records and building the social network for 32 years, ultimately finding over 50,000 ties among 5,000 people and making what I think is the longest and perhaps for the first time a kind of social network movie where we could day by day follow this network almost as if it were a living creature for over 30 years. And that was the data development effort that then allowed us to investigate some of the topics we're discussing today.
So then you run this through, I guess, computer models and sort of look at it from a variety of perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, the best metaphor I can give for this is that obviously people have been working on networks for many years before we started working on networks. This field goes back at least 100 years, and since the 1970s there have been lots of people. But most of the studies that had been done used static cuts of the networks. And it would be like trying to understand the game of cricket in England, the British game of cricket, by just looking at a single snapshot, trying to figure out what these guys are doing. But what we were able to do was to make a movie of the network. Now, if you're trying to understand the game of cricket and you have a movie, it's much easier for you to understand what's going on. And so what we did was to make movies of social networks. And that, in turn, is what allowed us to really make some progress scientifically.
Nicholas A. Christakis is my guest. He's professor of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine at Harvard University. His new book is called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. We'll be back in a moment, and you can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nicholas A. Christakis, professor of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine at Harvard University. His new book, written with James H. Fowler, is called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 to join the conversation, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Nicholas, my next-door neighbor, who has become a good friend, has been dieting religiously lately and is taking really good care of her body. And ordinarily, I would say good for her. But reading your book, I'm thinking maybe this is good news for me, too.
Yes, I think it is good news for you, and then therefore for me, too, now that I've heard this. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the book is how all kinds of phenomena related to voting, our economic lives, how we find dates and what kind of sexual practices we engage in, to a host of health-related phenomena spread, and you're now highlighting one of them. We looked at the spread of obesity in social networks, and we found that if your friends gained weight or lose weight, this affects your probability of gaining or losing weight. That's not too surprising. Most people know that, but we found that the effect didn't just stop there. We found that if your friends' friends gained or lost weight, it spread through the network, and if your friends' friends' friends gained or lost weight, it spread through the network and affected you. And these are people you don't even know. And in fact, we also found a very interesting kind of skipping behavior as well. So for example, let's say you have Tom, Dick, and Harry again. Tom might gain weight, and this might spread from Tom to Dick to Harry without Dick gaining weight in between. And how can that be? Well, sometimes there are just like they're carriers of germs. You know, someone... I get the germ from you and you're sick, but it doesn't affect me. I'm just a carrier, and then I pass it on to someone else who then becomes sick. The same kind of thing can happen with ideas and with behaviors. In the case of obesity, for instance, or weight loss, weight gain or weight loss, one way it might happen is the following. Let's say his friend Tom, starts gaining weight. Dick doesn't gain weight as a result of that, but let's say he becomes more tolerant of people gaining weight. Then when his friend Harry starts gaining weight, in the past he might have said something to Harry like, you know, gee, you're gaining some weight. But now because Tom, his first friend, has gained weight, he's less likely to do that. So the norm, as it were, of increasing acceptability of weight gain might pass from person to person, even though not everyone on the chain is actually affected. Now, we're picking on the example of weight here, but I need to stress, first of all, that I'm not suggesting any kind of prejudice towards people who are heavy, and our work has been widely misunderstood as suggesting that you should, you know, cut your ties to people who are heavy, which is not true, and we can discuss why if you're interested about that in a moment. But the example of weight gain and weight loss is illustrative of a broader set of processes we talk about in the book, about how norms and behaviors and even feelings can spread through social networks from person to person, and from person to person to person, and from person to person to person to person.
Well, before I get to my next question, let's explain why getting rid of all the people in your life who have habits that you don't want to have yourself is not going to do much.
Okay, so this is a very interesting question, and it's a little subtle. So let me set it up just a little bit. There are two kinds of ways that social networks affect us, what James and I call connection and contagion. The first thing is connection. It's just the simple fact of whether we have ties, whether our ties know each other. Like we talked about earlier, if you have two friends or four friends, and if you have four friends, whether your four friends know each other or they don't know each other, whether you're in the middle or on the edge of a network, these are all structural features of where you are in the network. This has to do with your pattern of connection. Okay. And second, in addition to that, is the issue of contagion. Given where you are in the network, what's flowing through the network and how might it affect you? Now, in the case of weight gain, for example, and we've actually looked at this, we've done statistical studies to look at this, on the one hand, if you were to cut the tie to a person who's gaining weight, you think, and it might, benefit you in the sense that you would no longer be subject, as it were, to this contagion of gaining weight. So that would be a contagion effect. On the other hand, if you cut the tie, you've now lost a friend. You have one fewer friend. This harms your health, you see? So the connection effect and the contagion effect can work at cross purposes. So any benefit you might have derived from cutting the tie to the person who's gaining weight is countermanded by the cost you paid by losing a friend. So This is very complicated, and it varies from circumstance to circumstance, but in general, when thinking about these effects, one has to take into account both the pattern of ties that surround oneself and also what's flowing through the ties, and frankly, the total benefit. I should say one of the big ideas in the book is that social networks are a force for good in our lives. Part of the reasons human beings evolved to have social networks, as we discussed earlier on the show, and part of the reason we are all embedded in social networks and have always been, is that, in fact, they're a net positive. So while things like germs and violence and depression and misinformation and suicide even can flow in social networks, which are all bad things, so too can things like love and happiness and information and kindness, and on balance, the flow of good things more than compensates for the flow of bad things. In fact, the flow of bad things through the networks is the kind of price we pay for the networks. These things have been sort of glommed on to an architecture that was built in evolution for a different reason. We are destined and programmed to be networked human beings. We don't just live in groups, we live in networks. And these networks function in very particular ways to enhance our lives.
Is it our position within the network that determines in any sort of two-way relationship which person influences the other to either have better health habits or worse health habits or more depression or less depression?
In general, both everyone influences everyone else in general. So for example, there was a study that looked at students who were randomly assigned roommates in college, and the studious students who were randomly assigned to the slacker students became a little bit more slackery, but the slackery students, they improved their grades. So studiousness can spread, at least from person to person in this study, and this was a nice study because the students were randomly assigned. It's not like the good students were hanging out with the good students preferentially, which of course also happens. So in general, things can go both ways. However, different phenomena spread with different intensity. So for example, and different effectiveness. So earlier when we were speaking about happiness, one of the things that James and I found is that although both happiness and unhappiness spread in social networks, happiness tends to spread with a little bit more reliably and a little bit more completely. It's as if, and I'm using this totally metaphorically, like the happiness bug is stronger than the unhappiness bug. So if you have two people, one of whom is happy and one of whom is unhappy, even though they both might influence each other, it's not like you're going to average the two effects out. My prediction is they'd be slightly happier than the average alone would indicate.
So we all have all these connections, Nicholas, throughout different elements of our lives, but not all, even peers, are created equal. For example, there's a difference between the influence our friends might have and our coworkers?
Yes, and we find, for instance, and it depends again on the phenomenon. I mean, James and I are often misunderstood. Not everything spreads. Many things spread in social networks, but not everything does. And not everything that spreads spreads the same way. I mean, for example, germs spread through society differently than money spreads through society. These are totally different phenomena. And ideas, let's say, spread differently than moods or emotions spread. And therefore, as well, the kinds of people we interact with can have different effects. For example, we found that smoking cessation behavior, whether you quit smoking or not, is influenced by whether or not a coworker of yours quits. But your happiness is not influenced by whether your coworker becomes happy. And some of our friends sort of joke that this is Schadenfreude. You know, when we hate it when our friends are successful. You know, when your buddy at work gets a raise, you're bummed. You know, you're not happy about that. But so the point is that in general terms, it does matter what kind of contact we're talking about. Is it your spouse, your sibling, your neighbor, your coworker, your friend, your Facebook friend, or your real friend? But it also depends on what process we're discussing. For example, you know, if you're trying to find a job, actually turns out that your friends of friends and your coworkers' coworkers or former coworkers of yours are very good sources of a job, even though they're not good sources of happiness.
Does this influence change over time? You know, we always think about adolescents being at sort of the apex of their ability to be influenced by the people around them. Is it stronger in younger people?
I mean, there's a huge literature on this. And in general, social influence processes work better in young. And, for example, the few suicide epidemics that have been documented tend to afflict, you know, teenagers. It's hard to imagine an adult being influenced by the suicide of a friend to take their own life in the same way that sometimes we see these unfortunate occurrences of suicide epidemics, which we also discuss in the book. But I think it is an overstatement to say that adults are immune from these kinds of social influence processes. So, yes, teenagers are more impressionable, but all of us are influenced, even those of us that are not teenagers anymore.
What tells you, Nicholas, that this can't be entirely explained by the fact that we tend to look for and attract people who share our values, our interests, things that would already make us more likely to gain or lose weight together or smoke or not smoke?
That's a fantastic question. So a whole lot of careful work needs to be done if you're trying to make a claim that influences what's happening here. And sometimes, of course, you can do an experiment. James and I have done some experiments where we've randomly assigned people to get certain kinds of exposures and then watch what flows through the network. Other times you have to use some fancy statistics to figure out what's happening. And let me then just walk your listeners through an example. Let's say I find two people who are friends with each other and they're both poor. Well, there are three possible explanations for this. Maybe they preferentially form their friendship because they're both poor, and let's say rich people hang out with rich people and poor people with poor people, and so that's why we're finding a connection between two poor people. Another possibility is that they, and we're going to call that homophily, or birds of a feather flock together. Another possibility is that they both used to work at the same plant, and the plant closed down, and so now they've both been exposed to a plant closure, and so they both become poor at the same time. It's not that they formed their friendship because they were both poor. Instead, they both became poor simultaneously because they had a shared exposure to this outside factor. And this is what the social scientists and epidemiologists call confounding. And a third possibility is that one friend became poor because the other friend became poor. So, for example, I have a friend who's, you know, profligate. I keep giving him my money. I keep lending him money, and he keeps, you know, wasting it and spending it down. And so I lose all my money because he lost all his money. Or I copy his bad spending habits, let's say. And this would be social influence. And one can use a variety of statistical techniques to unpack these three phenomena to really tease out the effect of influence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Nicholas Christakis about his new book, Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. Let's go on the phone now to Dallas, calling from Denver. Hi, Dallas.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
All right. Well, Nicholas and Chris, I appreciate you guys taking my question. I've actually got two questions. One is a minor question. That is, do you use any outside resources such as MySpace or any online networking to get any of your any answers to any questions you guys have? And then the second one is I always find myself I'm kind of the middle light of that tangled bundle, as you used earlier. Do you find that any inside person uses their influence in one network to bring separate networks that would have never met otherwise? Do you ever see any of that causing major influence to all the networks, creating them to do anything that network would normally do? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Those are both good questions. The first one had to do with whether we've studied online networks, and the answer is yes. In the book, we have a whole chapter we call Hyperconnected, and we've done a number of studies looking at online networks. For example, we've looked at whether smiling spreads online, whether people who post smiley pictures of themselves on their Facebook profile, are they more likely to be surrounded by other people who are they linked to friends who have smiley pictures? We had to hand process, you know, thousands of pictures of people and code whether they were smiling or not. And we've looked at the spread of tastes in social networks, the spread of in online networks, music, movies, and so forth. And we find, again, that for certain things, but not everything, musical tastes will spread. On the second question, that's a very sophisticated question. It has to do with whether people can form a bridging function, which is a little different than being in the middle of a network, but is related. And so the idea here is that you can bring whole groups of people together by acting as the node in a network that connects two otherwise unconnected groups. And people who do that often are able to capitalize on the flow of information and derive social and sometimes even economic benefits from doing that, introducing different parties, as it were, to each other.
I was surprised to read that without any prompting, there are times in which people will report God is part of their social network. They will self-report that, and they will also report that their pets are part of their social network.
Yes. We have some wonderful work in the books, work done by other people. Dr. Mamali, Katalin Mamali, who's a psychologist in the United States, and he did some studies where he asked people to draw their social networks, and unprompted, these people put God as a node in their network. And actually, we think that the religious beliefs and ideas about God are actually deeply connected to our social proclivities. The fact that we wish to be connected is related to the fact that we wish to be connected to God, actually, or other inanimate objects. So for example, one sees that when people are socially isolated, it often increases their visions of, for example, sailors at sea will see mermaids, or isolated people will become more religious, or people who are lonely will begin to kind of personify their pets more. And all of these activities, we think, are deeply rooted not just in religious sensibilities, but also in a kind of biology of our brain that makes us desire connection, not just to people, but also to other kinds of phenomena in our lives.
My guest is Nicholas A. Christakis, professor of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine at Harvard University. His new book is called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. We'll resume the conversation in just a moment. You're welcome to give us a call at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nicholas A. Christakis. He's professor of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine at Harvard University. His new book is called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Nicholas, how do variables like race and gender affect the likelihood that someone to whom we are connected will have an influence on our lives or our behavior?
Well, it's clear that the attributes of other people to whom we're connected play a role in modifying or modulating the spread of different kinds of phenomena. I mean, the easiest example of this is some work we've done looking at drinking behavior and the spread of drinking behavior, and we find that the drinking behavior is very much modified or modulated by the women in the network. And we find that basically that if a woman you know starts drinking heavily, you're much more likely to follow suit than if a man you know starts drinking heavily. And conversely, that women resist drinking heavily much more than men do. And so partly this is for obvious reasons. It's a different social signal for a woman to drink heavily than for a man to drink heavily. But this is just a simple example of how the gender of the person is relevant to the kind of spreading processes we've been discussing. On the race thing, there's a lot of ways I could approach that, but I'll give you one example. There's something known as the widower effect, which is the propensity of the recently bereaved to die. So if my wife dies, my risk of death goes up afterwards, sometimes quite substantially, up to double in the first 6 months, my risk of death after my wife dies. And what we find is in African-American families, there's no widowhood effect. And part of the reason for this seems to be that the way in which widowhood is experienced in African American families is a little bit different, in the sense that if my wife dies, if I'm an African American man, I continue to get a lot of support from my wife's family. Whereas if I'm a white man and my wife dies, I become disconnected not just from my wife, but also from her family. And so there's a kind of embeddedness on average in African American families that seems to attenuate or decrease the intensity of the widowhood effect. It's a complicated topic, but we do also discuss this in Connected.
How do the people around us influence our self-perception?
Well, I mean, I think there's no doubt in which the regard that others hold us affects our own self-regard. We review in the book some interesting experiments which you couldn't really do in real life. You know, if I wanted to do an experiment to see how does your opinion of yourself and your own, let's say, appearance affect how you act in the world, it wouldn't be an easy thing to do because I don't have easy ways of manipulating your appearance. But on the online world, this can be done with avatars, and some people have done some very interesting experiments where they've given people at random either plain-looking avatars or really cool or attractive-looking avatars. And regardless of how cool or attractive you are yourself, if you're given a cool or attractive avatar, in the virtual world, you act like you're cool or attractive. So you begin to assume this kind of role. And other people treat you, of course, differently in the virtual world. But then the trick becomes, can we discern the difference between are you acting cool and attractive because you have a cool and attractive avatar, and that's how you see yourself, or are you acting cool and attractive because everyone else is treating you more deferentially? So then they did an experiment in which you're given a cool or attractive avatar, and everyone else interacts with you, but you're blocked out. Your face is blocked out, and your appearance is blocked out. So they don't know whether you're cool or attractive or not. And even in those experiments, you throw your weight around. You act as if you're really, you know, the cat's meow in that circumstance. So the point I guess I'm making is that we take our signals from others, yes, but we also form in our own minds our own idea of how we should interact with others, and these experiments cleverly show that.
And what sort of information have you been able to uncover in terms of how we choose mates and how our networks might affect that?
Well, I mean, in part, we became very interested in this topic in part because of how I met my wife, my own wife, which is a story we tell in the book. And we actually find a bunch of stories about how people meet their partners, and often these involve seemingly chance encounters of friends of friends. You know, you go to a party, you weren't thinking of going, your friend drags you there, and there at the party you meet the love of your life, or you're set up by another friend of friend or something like that. And we review data done by other investigators that show that something like 60 or 70% of people, spouses, started out as friends of friends. As friends, friends of friends, or friends of friends of friends. And in fact, if you do a little back-of-the-envelope calculations, while you might think you could marry anyone on the planet, there are 7 billion people, in fact, if you're single, your future spouse is probably one of the 10,000 people that's within 3 degrees removed from you. And that person is just waiting there right now for you to find them. And we talk a little bit in the book about how this process works, how our social networks working in the background in this invisible way we talked about at the beginning of the program, you know, serve up our soulmates in the same room when we least expect it. You know, your friend of friend, you know, has a party, and before you know it, there you are with this person that you love. And that is how social networks, one of the ways that they work. And related to that, we also review in the book a variety of other kinds of phenomena that sexual and romantic-related phenomena that spread in social networks, whether it's sexual practices or things like divorce or fertility. You know, is having babies contagious? Yes, is the answer. When your friends start having babies, it increases your risk of having babies, and so forth. So we look again at all these seemingly very private and intimate things, your mood, your decisions about smoking, your body size, your sexual practices, who you vote for, and all of these things in very fundamental ways tap into and reflect what's going on in this invisible network that surrounds us all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ken in Dallas. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. You know, this is a timely topic. I was telling him before last about Eric Hoffer's The True Believers, which I'm sure your guest is familiar with, and, which is about groups, and I guess you'd say social groups. And I'm really fascinated with the new groups like the Tea Party people and the people who are real strong adherents to what's called talk radio, conservative talk radio. Are these social groups? And I'm curious if your guest thinks that these people, the people join these groups because of their beliefs, or just because they see a group of people that they may have, you know, something in common with. You know, there's somebody like me, maybe I should join that group.
Thanks for your call. Were you able to hear that pretty well, Nicholas?
No, unfortunately. Could you summarize a question for me, Chris?
Yeah, he was asking about these newer sort of political groups that are forming, like the Tea Party and things that have been influenced by AM talk radio and the discussions there, and whether or not people join, the reasons that might explain why people join these groups, and whether they count as social networks.
So that phenomenon is more like the plant closure phenomenon we discussed earlier. So these two people, the people who are party to this group at the beginning, both have been prompted to join, let's say, the Tea Party group because of a talk radio host. It's not like they, it's like a plant closure causing two friends to become poor at the same time. Some third factor puts these two people into a similar state. Now, once they're in that state, once they're both poor, or once they both, let's say, have joined a kind of radical group and are beginning to think, you know, have, you know, let's say, extreme politics on the right or on the left, then they can reinforce each other. And this is the other thing that's very, a very fundamental idea about social networks that's often misunderstood, which is that social networks tend to magnify whatever they are seeded with. So going back to the obesity epidemic, or actually, taking a step back even from that, when we first started investigating obesity, we thought that we would be able to see obesity spreading like a wave on the surface of a pond. You know, one person would gain weight, and then their friends would gain weight, and their friends' friends would gain weight, and you'd see this sort of wave of obesity spreading, just like if you dropped a pebble on a pond. But the crucial thing to understand is that for a wave to occur, someone has to drop a pebble. So for obesity, the obesity epidemic to take place, something else has to get it started. You know, sedentary lifestyles in our society, suburbanization or declining real price of food or marketing of food or whatever. And once it happens, then the network can kick in. Or another example might be an isolated island of individuals. There's no epidemic on this island of disease until the sailor washes ashore, and then he brings a germ, infects the first person he sees, and then that person infects the rest, and the whole island takes off. The island was fine until the first person seeded it, until someone kicked it off, and then the network takes over and magnifies the epidemic. So networks will magnify whatever they are seeded with, and this can include extreme political ideology as well, where people will all sort of reinforce each other's ideas, and things can spread within the network.
We have an email here from Lisa in Little Elm who asks, I know that when I moved from one place to another, things I was liked for in one place kept me out of social circles in another. So how does geography affect social networks?
Well, that there's a lot there, too. I mean, there's no doubt in which our geography, like where we live, affects who we know and what kinds of people we can befriend. But I would rather turn that on its head and say that what our book is really about is how what really matters in our lives is who we know, who our friends are, more than where we live, especially in modern times where in many ways we're able to transcend distance. So the kind of experience I have in my life, the kinds of tastes that I have, the kinds of activities I engage in are typically going to be influenced much more by my social circle than my geographic range.
At the stage where the research is now, is there a way to take this information that you've gathered and harness it to the benefit of ourselves and our networks?
I mean, there are a variety of things, yes, that can be done. I mean, we talk in the book at length about various policy implications of the kind of work. I think one of the basic things to realize is that to the extent that we're all connected, we all have an interest in enfranchising individuals who are disenfranchised. People on the outskirts or on the periphery of the network, we can't just ignore their plight and think, oh, it doesn't matter what's happening to them, any more than we would ignore an epidemic of a disease that's occurring to some individual. You know, you have a TB outbreak in a prison, you can't just say, oh, well, who cares, it's just in a prison. No, that outbreak can spread. And same goes with a variety of other kinds of phenomena that we're seeing. So whether it's epidemics of loneliness or poverty, or uninsurance, the people that are uninsured, it's not just that they lack health insurance and it's just their problem. Their lack of health insurance affects the rest of us as well. So one of the key insights from this vision of connection and this understanding of social contagion is that all kinds of phenomena can spread through the network. But I also wanted to go back to the point I made earlier, which is that the reason we live our lives in social networks is fundamentally because they're a force for good. And the fact that they can magnify whatever they are seeded with means that some strategic interventions at a policy level or a legal level or even at a local level can have substantial implications for a variety of processes, including health in particular.
Yeah, one of the things, a lot of efforts to get people back into shape have focused on the individuals who have the problem. And in fact, that may not be the most effective way to handle it.
That's exactly right. And in fact, our work would suggest it's not, that the best way to tackle some of these problems, for example, smoking or weight gain, is to target groups of interconnected people. And in some ways, this is not new either, because things like Alcoholics Anonymous and Weight Watchers and Narcotics Anonymous, these kinds of groups are artificial social networks. They work precisely because they cultivate a set of ties between individuals, and these ties reinforce, again, magnify whatever they are seated with, reinforce the kind of positive behavior they're trying to foster. So many of these kinds of things that we are used to thinking of as being very individualistic actually are not, actually are very deeply collective and were designed to be collective from the moment we emerged from the African savannah.
Are there different patterns of connections that people maintain online that would vary widely from the kinds of connections that people have in sort of real life?
I mean, here we our take on the internet is that it's the same but different. So yes, I mean, things on the internet are different. You know, you can have thousands of friends, so-called, on Facebook in the way you wouldn't in the real world. Or you could, you know, have an able-bodied avatar if you're a disabled person. Or you can have a female avatar if you're a man, and vice versa. These are the kinds of things that would be very difficult to do in real life. And yet, it's also the same online. I mean, the fundamental desire for connection, the fundamental interest in being influenced by others, these kinds of processes are the same on the internet as they are in the real world. And in fact, in some of our work, we've looked at Facebook friendship networks, for example. We find that while you might have hundreds of friends online, in the end, you're only really influenced by your six or so real friends among those hundreds that really have an impact on you because of all the fundamental ways that we are embedded in human social networks.
Nicholas A. Christakis is professor of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine at Harvard. His new book is called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. Nicholas, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.